From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Iraq coming apart, Eric Cantor's historic upset, unnerving shooters in Nevada, Oregon, and Hillary Clinton makes the rounds, a stunning collapse of Iraq's military, of much of Iraq as insurgents take city after city sweeping toward Baghdad. It began in Mosul.
All the people have fled. They have left their homes and many people are lying dead on the streets. Will Iraq accept this?
Republican House Majority Leader Eric Cantor trounced by a Tea Party opponent in his home district primary, stepping down.
Effective July 31st, I will be stepping down as Majority Leader. It is with great humility that I do so, knowing the tremendous honor it has been to hold this position.
And Hillary Clinton in the limelight on her new book, 2016 and Benghazi.
If you had one do-over from your 4 years,
it would be Benghazi. If I could turn the clock back and we could have figured out a way to avoid that, we certainly would have.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Crowley of Time Magazine, Ryan Grimm of The Huffington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are we seeing in Iraq right now? What about in the GOP? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, Michael Crowley, Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Time Magazine. Michael Crowley, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. And from Washington, Ryan Grimm joins us, Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post. Ryan, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
And with me here in the studio today, Jack Beatty. Great to have you right here, Jack.
Great to be here, Tom. Hello, Ryan and Michael.
Let's drive straight into Iraq. Michael Crowley, what are we witnessing? I hesitate to even say where the line of battle is as we speak. People who will hear us in different times over the next 24 hours, and it's just been moving and moving closer to Baghdad. What is going on here, Michael?
Something that feels a little like Armageddon, Tom, unfortunately. I'm being a little flip, but in the context of that region, it's hard to be hyperbolic about the stakes and the severity of what's happening. Essentially, to boil it down, we're watching the potential collapse of the state of Iraq, and the very alarming rise of an extremely radical Islamic militant group, ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, which is marching down across the border from Syria, where it's been most active, and at last report actually threatening the capital of Baghdad. This is a group so extreme and so brutal that it's actually been basically kicked out of Al-Qaeda. The Al-Qaeda leadership said, "We don't want anything to do with you guys. You're so vile." They have taken several major Iraqi cities, including Mosul, which is the second largest city in the country. The complications go on and on longer than you probably want an answer to this question. We can return to them. But now you have the Kurds coming in and claiming territory, taking back the city of Kirkuk from ISIS. And you have a call from Iraq's leading Shiite cleric for Shiites to rise up and fight these Sunni militants. Who are incredibly hostile towards Shiites, are threatening to destroy precious Shiite shrines in the country. Essentially, a sectarian civil conflict spilling out of Syria into Iraq that could infect the entire region, that threatens the stability of the Iraqi state, and may draw the United States militarily back into Iraq, despite how much President Obama does not want to do that. So much to talk about there, but basically something that looks really awful and may get much worse before it gets better.
Ryan Grimm, do you hear people in Washington looking over and saying, my God, Iraq is coming apart, maybe the whole region?
Yes, for sure. Now, you've had some of the typical partisanship coming out of Washington. The House Republicans are blaming President Obama for this. Obama's supporters are blaming President Bush for starting the war in the first place. But underneath all that, there are very serious discussions going on about what the response will be. And the president has very specifically not ruled out bombing. We live in a world now where, a convoy of 100 Toyotas riding across the desert is really at the mercy of the president of the United States. He can snap his fingers and annihilate that convoy. And that's what they're discussing now, whether or not they're gonna bring airstrikes into this situation, and whether or not that would improve it or possibly make it spiral even further out of control.
Jack Beatty, that may be true, but at this point, they're no longer just sprinting across the desert. They are in the cities, taking almost $500 million out of the bank in Mosul, we're told. We've seen the Iraqi army just disappear. Reports that they're wearing civilian clothes under their uniforms. This is the army, the military, that the U.S. spent years and billions training up. Can the U.S. really come in here and do something from the air once these ISIS troops, militants, are in the cities?
Only at the risk, at the sure risk, at the certainty of killing many, many civilians. And the effect of that always is counterproductive.
You know, Jack, I have to interject here. We saw so many, tens of thousands, at least hundreds of thousands, heading out of Mosul, and many of them saying they were leaving not because of the militants coming in, but because they were afraid Baghdad would just bomb the city, just shell it, or Americans would come and level it from the sky.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's no policy there that makes any sense. And now they say there are staging areas here and there. You know, I mean, I think one narrative we're going to hear is, what about the opportunity costs here in American foreign policy? John Kerry, you know, I think he has to be applauded for his efforts in Middle East peace. But what about that? Was that a distraction during those months? Should we have been, you know, forcing Maliki to face facts, basically saying, tomorrow we cease all aid unless you appoint Sunnis to your government now? Were we doing that? I don't believe we were. Did we fritter that opportunity away? Perhaps. Could anything have been done? We don't know. But the feeling is that just has been, you know, that our administration has been caught flat-footed, that it's an inbox presidency, crisis of the week, and we're not ahead of events.
Not up to speed. Of course, the debate goes all the way back to never mind the beginning of the Iraq War, it goes there. But it certainly goes back to 2011 when we took all those troops out, did not find a status of forces agreement to allow some kind of stabilizing force to stay on. Let's just get a sense of the thinking of the group that has swept with such speed across Iraq this week. This is audio purportedly of Abu Muhammad Adnani, official spokesman for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It's been released where he urges fighters to march on to the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. I don't have the English on tape, but let me, and this is colorful language, just roll up your sleeves of seriousness. He's talking to these black-garbed militants. Do not give up one span of land you've liberated. Do not let the Shia step back on that land except over your body parts. March to Baghdad, the Baghdad of the Caliphate. This is the dream of a big fundamentalist Islamic state there in the region. We have a score to settle, for there is an old balance with it. We must make it even. Michael Crowley, these guys coming in, it's hard to picture how they did all this so quickly. There don't appear to be that many in the photos coming out. How is it Iraqi Sunnis rising up to join them? Is it the simple near disillusion of the Iraqi army in their path? What's happened here, Michael?
Yeah, those are important factors. Jack touched on them. You know, a really essential part of the story here is the reign of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He has become essentially a Shiite dictator, and in the view of many experts, a kind of Shiite replacement for Saddam Hussein, who was the Sunni dictator for so many years. He has not governed inclusively. He has essentially purged and prosecuted and oppressed Sunnis in his country, and is perceived as a kind of brutal sectarian figure. So what you have are Sunnis in Iraq who feel like their government is out to get them and are inclined to support someone who is coming after Maliki and his Shiite supporters, who feel like the enemy of my enemy can be my friend in the near term. One way that manifests itself in terms of support among sort of other armed groups who are not actually ISIS, remnants of the insurgency that the United States fought during our occupation.
Remnants of Saddam's regime, really, in many ways.
That's right. There is a former senior commander from Saddam's military, one of the most senior guys who was on the he was a card in that famous deck of playing cards that George Bush had of all the guys we wanted to hunt down. We never got him. He's still out there. He appears to be commanding some forces who appear to be playing a role in what's been happening the last several days. And the other key point here is that members of the soldiers in the Iraqi military, Sunni soldiers, apparently believe, what kind of government am I fighting for? Maliki is essentially a Shiite thug who is treating Sunnis terribly. And so their morale is extremely low, and they are leaving. They are fleeing. They are deserting. Last point, Maliki has purged and removed some of his talented military leaders who are Sunnis in a way that kind of reminds me of the way Joseph Stalin purged many of his senior generals early in the 1930s. And when the Germans invaded his country, his army was incompetent because he had kicked out a lot of his or murdered a lot of his best guys. The same thing has happened with Saddam, where military leaders who were Sunni have been removed from the military, and that's impacted morale and competence. So all these things have left Iraq, or Maliki very vulnerable. His military is wobbly, and the local population is hostile toward him, and again, willing to cut a kind of enemy of my enemy is my friend deal. Last thing I'll say is just that our hope is, as happened during the U.S. occupation, these Sunni Iraqis will find that the Islamic radicals affiliated with al-Qaeda or no longer affiliated with al-Qaeda, but who have those kinds of sympathies are too brutal, are too extreme, and won't be able to maintain an alliance for them for very long because they don't share their ideology.
A decade and 4,000 U.S. military lives in Iraq, and in the space of a week, so much of that turf gone to a few guys in black. Ryan Grimm, Michael Crowley, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. Listeners, you can join us. Is all we fought for in Iraq going up in smoke? Should the U.S. get involved? Stay out of it. 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Gunfire there with Al-Akbar in the streets of Tikrit this week. We're looking at a week in the news. Iraq coming apart. Eric Cantor's historic upset. School shooting. Cop killing. Hillary Clinton telling her story this week. Michael Crowley is with us, chief foreign affairs correspondent at Time Magazine. Ryan Grimm, Washington bureau chief for The Huffington Post, is here. Jack Beatty is with us. We'll come right to your calls, but a few voices from Washington here. Here's the president yesterday talking about the everything going on, saying no options ruled out in Iraq.
But what we've seen over the last couple of days indicates the degree to which Iraq's going to need more help. It's going to need more help from us, and it's going to need more help from the international community. So my team is working around the clock to identify how we can provide the most effective assistance to them. I don't rule out anything because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria.
Well, wow, so much to look at there. Republican Lindsey Graham, Senator of South Carolina, saying this threat will come here.
To the American people, I know you're war-weary, I know you're tired of dealing with the Mideast, but the people that are moving into Iraq and holding ground in Syria have as part of their agenda not only to drive us out of the Mideast, but in our homeland. The head of the FBI said that the pipeline for the next 9/11 attack is likely to come from Syria.
And Arizona Senator Republican John McCain saying there's a fiasco here, heads should roll. How far back? Well, he's just looking at who's sitting in those seats right now. McCain.
Drastic measures need to be taken. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is one who has gone along with this policy for a long time. We need a new chairman. We need a new national security advisor. We need a new team. We need a new team that knows what America's national security interests are and are more interested in national security than they are in politics.
Oh, well, you could take that line back some years. Let's go to our listeners. Ahmad in Nashville, Tennessee. Ahmad, you're on the air.
Thanks for the opportunity for letting me talk. I just have a comment that what do we really value in here? Is that human life is what we value? Because if that's what it is, this is nothing new. There is people dying there. And I watched, I've been listening to the news in Iraq. I mean, this has been happening, people dying there since 2003, every day. And this is nothing new. Now, this, terrorist group now took over. Now, they're going to be responsible for killing a lot more people.
Ahmad, the line is rough. You say nothing new. I mean, in a sense, you're right. There's been a lot of killing going on for many years. On the other hand, Michael Crowley, people are talking here about the whole Sykes-Picot post-World War I boundary map of the region coming apart. That's new.
That is new. So there's a way in which what we're seeing now portends the possibility of much broader chaos. We did see some hints of this at the lowest of the U.S. occupation when, you know, as was the case at that time, there's concern about Iranian involvement, about the Saudis, about the Turks, about Kurds making claims to independence that would really turn the entire region upside down, could lead to mass chaos, threaten the stability of wobbly governments like the one we see in Jordan, spill into Lebanon. But I think there's something more, there's another really important point, at least as far as it applies to the debate in Washington, which is that there has been a lot of terrible things have happened in Iraq, and there has been a lot of killing since the United States left. But the reason this really has Washington's attention right now is the belief that ISIS is a dangerous terrorist organization with plans and perhaps soon, perhaps already, the capability to strike Westerners, to strike at Americans. This group has money. They seem to have plundered possibly millions. Some people say hundreds of millions. I doubt it's that much, but millions of dollars in their rampage. They certainly aspire to attack Western targets, and they are acquiring so much territory that they may be able to develop something like a safe haven where they can train to attack Westerners. They also have many European volunteers who have come to join the fight with passports to go back to Europe. That really focuses the attention of the Obama administration and makes them think, we can't just watch this unfold and sit back lest we have another Afghanistan 2001.
Though their instinct has clearly been not to be involved here, and many Americans share that. Matthew in Castleton, Vermont. Matthew, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I think this is the turn of violence there seems pretty inevitable because, you know, the borders like the Sykes-Picot border were, you know, artificially drawn. They cut across the different nations that are there. So it seems inevitable that in the north, west of Iraq and Syria, that there'll be some sort of Sunni state forming. And I just can't imagine that we can say that the entire world and everything that happens in the entire world is in our interest. But when you have, you know, the best hammer that's ever been made, every problem in the world seems to look like a nail. But you can't say the entire world is in our interest when this seems pretty inevitable.
Are American interests involved right here? Well, that's the debate right now. Has the Obama administration done the right thing by pulling back, getting out of wars here that Americans very much were sick of? Or is a vacuum being created? And you don't have to be all in or all out. Has it been too inattentive kind of in the details here? Ryan Grimm, how does that debate look to you? When the president says that nothing is ruled out, what does he appear to be contemplating here? Could we see American airstrikes? We've already saw some, within the last weeks in support of Iraqi forces. Could we come in heavier? Is there something else that might happen here?
No, we certainly could see some airstrikes because what we're looking at is a host of very, very bad options. And so, you know, if they can put their finger on a least bad option, which is to launch a few airstrikes, then they may do that. But nothing that they do, you know, is going to fundamentally change the situation that we're talking about here. You know, when the United States invaded, it destroyed all of Iraq's existing institutions under the kind of mantra of freedom is untidy. And we did not build up any new institutions. And that's why you're seeing the army collapse so quickly, because there's nothing underneath it. And, you know, eight years of that led to an Iraqi population in 2011 that did not want the United States to stay. You know, the president is being attacked right now for not being able to negotiate a status of forces agreement and for leaving Iraq. The Iraqis did not want us to stay there. They would not grant U.S. soldiers immunity protection operating within their country, which means that U.S. soldiers would be at the whim of the Iraqi justice system at any time they left a base. And, you know, I don't think is anyone in Washington who would accept those terms to leave soldiers in Iraq. So it's not as if he even had much of a choice to make. This was a decision that was made in 2002 and 2003, and these are the horrific consequences that we're living with today.
Jack, here, of course, I should be clear. It was the U.S. provided Hellfire missiles and some low-tech surveillance drones last year when Fallujah was under pressure and Maliki asked for those out of Baghdad. But where do we go here now? I mean, there was so much complaint about overreach, and now we have the New York Times editorial opining today that the dangers of American underreach have been lavishly and horrifically displayed, their writing, this week in Iraq.
Yes, that by David Brooks, who was one of the, most vigorous proponents of intervention in Iraq, and whose judgment in this regard, I think, has to have that parenthesis around it, as does the judgment of Senators McCain and Graham. Their line is, if only, there was a if only we had kept those troops in 10,000 forces after 2011, why they could have completed the training. $25 billion have gone into training and equipping this army. Armies, it isn't about training in an army. Look at the Kurds. It's about morale. It's about motivation. It's about having something to fight for. These forces haven't been given it. They've been fighting for a corrupt government.
Certainly not by us and by their own government.
Absolutely. I mean, this recalls the last days of South Vietnam, when soldiers who had fought extremely bravely for the longest time simply couldn't go on fighting for that corrupt government.
So maybe overreach on a vast scale a decade ago, but here we've seen Syria just coming undone, and we've said from the very earliest days, everybody we've had on here has said, if Syria comes completely undone, that will be the unraveling of the region, and here we are.
And they have predicted it, and it is happening. And then the sort of retrospect about Syria is, suppose the president in 2012, I think it was, had done what Hillary Clinton et al. Wanted him to do and armed the, quote, moderate rebels. Maybe that would have made a difference. Would it have? I mean, didn't we see, we remember talking on the show about a base that we had set up in the north of Syria that it had been a sort of a Syrian opposition base where lots of equipment had accrued, and in came the jihadis and took all the equipment and left. I mean, could that have happened to our arming the moderates? And what would Senator McCain have said then?
Michael Crowley, we've got to move to domestic politics. They've been very big this week. But one last question on this, and we will talk more about this right here on Monday. But is there some way in which this becomes self-congealing or correcting within the neighborhood, that this is too much for Iran, this is too much for Saudi Arabia, that the local big players say, wait a minute, this can't go on? Do you see the propensity and the power for them to stop this or not?
I do. I think that there's reason to hope that we don't, the U.S. doesn't have to get involved. The scenario where we don't, and I mean, the best case scenario is the Iraqis kind of get their act together. They may have been caught somewhat by surprise. They regroup. We step up the intelligence that we give them. Apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, we've already been flying surveillance drone flights, and they are able to fight back, and with the help of the Kurds. Now, that's complicated in its own way, but we'll deal with that another time. Yeah. The more complicated scenario, but that one that also keeps us out, is Iran really steps up its involvement. They send in basically troops of their own. And Iran has a lot of capability. The Saudis, I don't think, play a role at this moment. But yes, there are other actors in the region who can kind of get this done. And I think there's a good possibility that happens. The problem is, the more you bring in outsiders, the more you have resentments toward those outsiders, counterattacks, and the possibility for an escalation where things spiral out of control. So I think we're hoping very much that Maliki's forces can regroup and do this on their own, maybe with some help from the Kurds.
Maybe. I'm not sure anybody else can get it done. I mean, look at Syria. They support Assad. He's been up against the wall here for years now, while ISIS has grown right there in Syria. We'll come back to this on Monday in a big, big way. I want to turn to domestic politics. And, of course, that means Eric Cantor, Republican majority leader in the House never before has, if I've got this right, since that position was established, has such a figure been toppled in a primary. But he was. Here is that most unexpected primary victory speech. This was Tuesday night. The Tea Party Republican in Virginia's 7th congressional district and victor over the House majority leader. This is Dave Bratt talking about his winning principles.
It's about returning the country to constitutional principles. It's about returning the country to Judeo-Christian principles. And it's about returning this country to free market principles where no one is favored.
Talk about David and Goliath. There's Dave Bratt. Ryan Grimm, what happened under the feet of Eric Cantor?
Sure, it was an earthquake, and this wasn't just the majority leader getting taken out. This was really the Speaker of the House in waiting.
In waiting, yeah.
And this was not somebody who had the backing of the National Tea Party. It was not, unless you count Laura Ingraham talking about him on her radio show. He had famously he spent as much on his campaign as Eric Cantor spent recently at steakhouses, and that's an actual statistic.
Yeah, we saw that. On the other hand, right. We had Matt Kibbe on from FreedomWorks, big Tea Party affiliation, and he was very happy with his victory.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, everybody wants to ride his coattails for sure. Michelle Bachmann and Steve King, Tea Party leaders in Congress, were saying that this is a huge national Tea Party win, and it justified actually delaying the election so that they could find a more conservative candidate to replace him. But I think that Tea Party is not a perfect label for him. He has this mix of you heard the Judeo-Christian values that he was talking about in his victory speech, mm-hmm. there, but he also was very populist in a way that recalled the kind of late 19th century, and also recalls Democrat Elizabeth Warren in some ways. He talks a lot about crony capitalism. He talks mm-hmm. about the system being rigged against regular people. He talks about New York and D.C. together. It's kind of one
the Wall Street Washington combine.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He does not talk like a typical U.S. Chamber of Commerce Republican candidate. And so I think the bottom line here is that this represents anger at the establishment, anger at Washington, anger at New York and Wall Street. And I think both bases are going to be watching out for this.
So where does it turn Republicans in Washington if they've got their finger in the wind and they see this victory and it's not a straight up Tea Party, you say? How do they read this wind in terms of their own positions, policies?
Well, the irony for the Tea Party and for national conservatives here is that they're going to replace Eric Cantor with California's Kevin McCarthy. And McCarthy is, if anything, more moderate than Eric Cantor, although that implies that he kind of has his own politics, which I think might be overstating it. He's one of these politicians who's been running for some type of office for the better part of his life. As a freshman member of the California State Assembly, he ran for Republican assistant leader and won the position. It was basically a thankless task because the Republicans are so far in the minority in California. But that's the kind of guy this is.
But not a hard bar Tea Party conservative, you're saying, which is kind of amazing after this.
Not even remotely, and I think it just confirms to the Tea Party, how out of touch Washington is. The problem for them is that leadership elections are typically not about political ideology. Some members of Congress don't even understand that, but they're about personal relationships and they're about vote counting. And McCarthy had the relationships, and he was currently the number three, the whip, which meant he was in charge of vote counting. He immediately got on the phone and started making calls before Cantor's body had gone cold, while others who were deciding whether or not to run said they were praying on it and they were talking to their family. And by the time they had gotten done praying, he had effectively locked up the number two spot.
But this story cannot be over. Jack, I can't remember the last time I heard the word earthquake used so many times around Washington in 1 week, except for the Washington Monument and National Cathedral chipping off.
That's it. I mean, and look at Kevin McCarthy. I see here he gets $355,000 from the financial sector for his reelection, even though he doesn't have an opponent.
Watch this space. Ryan Grimm, Michael Crowley, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at A Week in the News, 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, protests in the street of Brazil and World Cup mania. The host country beat Croatia 3-1. Brazil's first goal came from superstar Neymar.
Neymar! Neymar! E salta!
We are excited. Referee controversy there, but on it goes actor-comedian Tracy Morgan, still in critical condition after a Walmart semi-trailer truck ran into his van Saturday night. Comic Harris Stanton was on board with Morgan.
We're talking, we're cracking jokes, and there's no window in the back, so wasn't able to brace ourselves for anything, didn't hear anything. And the next thing I know, I just crunching metal all around me.
Boy, that looked rough. And Broadway star Audra McDonald won her sixth Tony Award for her portrayal of Billie Holiday. She paid tribute to the women who she said made her career possible.
I am standing on Lena Horne's shoulders. I'm standing on Maya Angelou's shoulders. I'm standing on Diane Carroll and Ruby Dee. And most of all, Billie Holiday. You deserved so much more than you were given when you were on this planet. This is for you, Billie. Thank you so much.
Audra McDonald at the Tonys, and of course, one of those greats she acknowledged, award-winning actress Ruby Dee, died at her home on Wednesday. She was 91. We're looking at A Week in the News. Iraq coming apart. Eric Cantor's historic upset, school shooting, cop killing, Hillary Clinton telling her story. Michael Crowley is with us, chief foreign affairs correspondent at Time Magazine. Ryan Grimm, Washington bureau chief at the Huffington Post. Jack Beatty is here. More to say on Eric Cantor. Here he was on Wednesday after losing that primary, saying he would give up the House majority leadership. Here's Cantor.
I would say about the Tea Party, remember what the acronym means. Taxed enough already. All of us conservatives and Republicans believe in that. So I do believe that what we have in common as Republicans is a tremendous amount of commitment to a better and smaller government and greater opportunity and growth for everybody.
Sounds like rhetoric after his big loss. I don't know if he's in touch or not. Are the Democrats in touch? On MSNBC on Wednesday, Democratic Congresswoman from Florida, chair of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, said Cantor's loss showed that the Tea Party is in control of the GOP.
The Republican Party has been completely swallowed by the Tea Party. I mean, any debate over whether the Tea Party controls the Republican Party has ended. When Eric Cantor, who had the most conservative voting record in the House Republican leadership, can't win his own party's nomination because he wasn't conservative enough, then you know they have a serious problem.
Ryan Grimm, take one more pass at this. So you say it's not formal Tea Party exactly. It's populist. It's anti-Washington Wall Street, though that's got a Tea Party flavor to it. Help us again here. What is it that is on the rise? After all, Cantor's gone. It's got to mean something. People paying attention. Does this rally Republicans even more tightly around a very, very conservative agenda?
Well, I think one way to think about it is that there are actually two Tea Parties. There is a genuine grassroots populist Tea Party that consists of a lot of conservative activists very upset at the direction of the country. That's the one that threw Eric Cantor out. Then there is a kind of national Washington-based Tea Party that is variously funded by the Koch brothers and other huge Republican donors. And, you know, that includes, groups like FreedomWorks, that you were talking about earlier, and that element of the party is very strong within the GOP, but it does not control the party because it has to compete with your Karl Roves, your wealthy donors, your U.S. Chamber of Commerce. However, on the ground, I think it is fair to say that the grassroots Tea Party in the Republican primaries is significantly dominant. Debbie Wasserman Schultz's point is worth taking. It was the most conservative member of Republican leadership, and he was effectively thrown out because he wasn't conservative enough. That can't be overlooked.
Let's go to Tim in Ames, Iowa. Tim, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You guys are already kind of addressing this a bit, but how much further to the right can the Republican Party go? I mean, my goodness, if someone as conservative as Eric Cantor can't win a Republican primary, I guess I'm asking, in terms of policy, what's left? I mean, what? How much further to the right can this party go?
Jack, I'll hand that to you.
Well, it can go a deal righter, I suppose. But look at that district. I saw this week that a poll of Republicans in that district found that over about 60% favored immigration reform, such as was passed by the Senate with the implicit amnesty in it. Those are Republicans. But only 13% of the vote, you know, of voters came out in the primary. Those 13% wanted no part of it. Mr. Cantor's problem was he was neither one thing nor the other. He could neither speak to the majority Republican sentiment in that district, which was, you know, this probably makes sense to do immigration reform.
He made noises like that,
which, of course, it underscored his inauthenticity among politicians. You know, there's a headline this week: everybody hates Eric Cantor. Well, they quote Eric Erickson, the conservative blogger, saying people were friends of his were saying, hooray, he's gone. Nancy Pelosi at her Georgetown apartment was, you know, they were having cheers when he went down. Morning Joe Scarborough, mm-hmm. said when he would come on the show, you could just see the politics of entourage. He'd have three security people with him.
Yeah.
You know, now that sends a message. I'm a big deal. I'm a satrap. I'm a big Washington guy. He does the same thing down there in Virginia, and people just say, this guy is so far out of touch.
So how to read this? I mean, Michael Crowley, weigh in here. We'll take you on this. If there's so much that's personal about it, does it swing the GOP toward a more conservative candidate for 2016, which could end up denying them the White House again? Or is this written off because Eric Cantor, you know, people got tired of his personality and his entourage and he's out?
Well, I don't think we can say right now, Tom, and that's the debate the party is going to have. You know, there's countervailing evidence here. I think not enough has been made of the fact, for instance, that Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina at one point was sort of the biggest, fattest target of the Tea Partiers. Managed to hold off the Tea Party primary run against him and basically coasted in. Now you hear local factors there as well, that he never really drew a very competent, organized opposition. Fine, but, you know, that is another data point. The Tea Party fevers felt hotter to me going into the last presidential campaign. You remember some of the kind of the madness in the GOP primaries, where it was Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich, and Mitt Romney prevailed in the end. So, you know, my inclination
and then lost as a moderate, as Tea Party people are quick to point
fair
out.
Fair enough, and that will be a new, a new data point for the Tea Partiers. I just want to say one last thing about kind of moving right and policy, which I think is really a really interesting question, which is, you know, what does it mean for the party to move farther to the right? Because if the Republican Party becomes more fully articulates Tea Party ideology, you know, it's Eric Cantor was very friendly to the financial services industry, to what you would call Wall Street and big money in Washington. And, you know, but I still don't see a lot of sign that the Republican Party is moving away from that position. And that's where I think you would really have a new iteration, a new fundamental change beyond these battles over the debt limit and Obamacare. You know, would we ever see a point where the Republican Party actually breaks with Wall Street and says, enough, the fat cats at the top are rich and getting richer. The whole thing is a game between Washington and Wall Street where everyone's enriching each other, the lobbyists and the politicians. There was a lot of that sentiment in Cantor's race, as I understand it, but it never really quite manifests itself in the Republican Party in Washington in a way that seems to make a big difference. And that, to me, is a fascinating storyline and something that I'll be watching.
That always intriguing but elusive point where it all wraps around and almost connects with Occupy Wall Street. Barbara,
exactly.
In Avon, Connecticut. Barbara, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The fact that Mr. Bratt spent such a small amount of money and had a very strong message, and when you keep saying, oh, the conservatives, you know, I don't feel like I'm that much a conservative. I just want the Constitution to be followed, and so does Mr. Bratt. And the Constitution is not being followed in Washington. And I think that we're all going to see a lot more of this. And it's not really Tea Party. It's just Americans that want the Constitution to be followed.
Barbara, where do you see the gap on constitutionality in particular?
Well, our president has signed over 1,200 executive orders, giving him powers to do more things than anyone realizes. And that was all done around the Congress. He had brought these five, let these five terrorists go without even talking to Congress about it.
I think we've got it, Barbara, and I really appreciate your point. I mean, loads of executive orders under George Bush before him, but plenty here as well. And what's interesting to me here, Ryan, is Barbara's picking up on that huge disparity in spending. It did not buy the election in the end, and that is an indication, though it may be very concentrated, as Jack points out, still, that's voter sentiment that won't be bought by television ads.
No, I think that's right, and I think you could see some of that elsewhere, although one point on that is that Eric Cantor's $2 million that he spent reminding voters that he had an opponent may have actually backfired on him.
Name recognition for Dave Brat.
Exactly, but you know, almost more than Lindsey Graham, I would suggest people look to the primary in Harlem the week after next, where Charlie Rangel is up against an insurgent candidate, and I think you're going to see a similar thing, that his opponent has been hammering him for votes to weaken Dodd-Frank and other pro Wall Street votes, which has basically never happened
in the Democratic Party.
Yeah. This is a New York primary. And people are reacting to it. I think the race is going to be extremely close, and I think he's in real trouble. And I think it's not because of his ethics troubles a few years ago. He already won re-election after that against this same person. I think this is the same kind of populist anti-establishment against the system energy that you saw in Virginia.
Let's talk about another Democrat with a few New York ties, Hillary Clinton, on book tour with her new memoir about her time as Secretary of State, talking here with Diane Sawyer Monday night. She was everywhere, but here she's talking once again about whether or not she'll run for president 2016.
I just want to kind of get through this year, travel around the country, help in the midterm elections in the fall, and then take a deep breath and kind of go through my pluses and minuses about what I will and will not be thinking about as I make the decision.
There's that side note. I'm handed a note here saying President Obama has signed under 200 executive orders. I don't have the number firm in front of me, but just to go there. Hillary Clinton talking about leaving the White House dead broke.
We came out of the White House not only dead broke, but in debt. We had no money when we got there, and we struggled to, you know, piece together the resources for mortgages, for houses, for Chelsea's education. You know, it was not easy.
Oh, so many houses to pay for, dead broke. But $12 million in debt is no small thing. Hundreds of thousands for speaking engagements. You can make it back. And one more here, and then we'll really look at Hillary. This is talking again with Diane Sawyer. Said she took responsibility for Benghazi, but she was not making security decisions at that level that would have had anything personally done to change the outcome.
What I did was give very direct instructions that the people who have the expertise and experience in security.
But personally,
apply. Well, that is personal, though, Diane. I'm not equipped to sit and look at blueprints to determine where the blast walls need to be or where the reinforcements need to be. That's why we hire people who have that expertise.
Jack Beatty, the Hillary Clinton show, really up on the rails this week. No declaration for 2016, but she is everywhere. What do you see as the spotlight comes on?
Well, you know, this is a really unpropitious time for her to be making her debut with the book Hard Choices about American
foreign affairs,
when what had been thought to be a strong suit of the Obama administration seems now to be coming apart. The reset with Russia, the chaos everywhere. I mean, the Middle East, wherever you look. Now she's going to have to answer for that, and she will. She's already begun to. I just differed with the president here. I made, you know, Syria. We know about that. She wanted to arm the rebels. She wanted to do more. She was very active on the escalation in Afghanistan. Was that a prudent? We'll have to see. What did she want to do with Iraq? She's going to have
hard time for bragging rights.
It's a very hard time for bragging rights on American foreign policy.
Ryan Grimm, do you see her laying effective groundwork here?
Sure. I mean, this will be good in the sense that she can work out some of the kinks because, you know, she's clearly rusty after not having campaigned since 2008. I mean, I'm sure she would love to take back her suggestion that they were dead broke. Whether or not it's factually true, it kind of net present value tells you that she's gonna be fine. You know, when you're making $200,000 for an hour long speech, that tends to add up fairly quickly. She had a difficult run in with NPR's own Terry Gross over her evolution on gay marriage. So, she's really working out some of her political kinks here if she does decide to run, next year. And
Tom, can I just throw in one point, which is that a subject she does not want back in the news is Iraq. Her vote for authorizing force in Iraq essentially cost her the Democratic primary nomination. And, she had a line or two about it in her book, I think, basically trying to just put it behind her once and for all. And if we're all debating again the wisdom of going into Iraq, what is the legacy of Iraq? How big a mess did we create? That's just not something – that's not somewhere she wants to go. She was hoping that was ancient history.
Violence at home this week. The two policemen shot in Las Vegas, assassinated really, and in Oregon in a school. Again, here was the president.
We're the only society – we're the only developed country on earth where this happens. And it happens now once a week. And it's a one-day story. There's no place else like this.
There are people with mental health issues everywhere, the president said, Jack, but we have more guns.
Triumphant common sense on the part of the president. And it's a plague. What do we have? Every week now we have in the schools one of these shootings.
70 some since Sandy Hook.
It the massacre of innocents just goes on and on. A few years ago, colleagues of mine at the Atlantic and I were in Little Rock. This was before the 92 election, talking to Bill Clinton, and someone asked him, "I beg your pardon?"
Sorry, Jack. Sorry.
Someone asked him, what would you do? What would you do about the NRA, about gun control? And he said, look, I'm from the South. The guns are part of a family's experience. What you've got to do is go behind the NRA to people in the South. You almost need a missionary work. Send people down there who've lost loved ones. Listen to stories of hunters. The hunters listen to the people in the cities. And over years, you can get some change.
I don't know what it's going to take, but a school shooting per week is nothing that any country should tolerate. Michael Crowley at Time Magazine, Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent. Great to have you with us today, Michael. Thanks so much for your time and thoughts.
My pleasure as always, Tom. Thank you.
Ryan Grimm at the Huffington Post. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack, great to have you right here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.